taxation number 22170, Real 2.
Nick Berryman, Real 2.
I remember being sent down with all the other guys marching down to Swiss Cottage. At Swiss Cottage, for the first time in my life, I had realised that I had been a very protected schoolboy, because there was I, thinking I knew all about life, but at Swiss Cottage we were shown films of the results of venereal disease. And this frightened the living daylights out of most of us to such a degree we decided we were going to be bachelors forevermore. But anyway, we got through that, and I must admit that that I treated my women folk with great respect from then on out while I was in the Royal Air Force, I can assure you. But anyway, Swiss Cottage came and went, and it wasn't long before, bored out of my brain, I volunteered to go down to Paddington Station rather than waste my time reading books and waiting in these flats at St John's Wood. I would go to Paddington Station to help load the trains up with luggage. On one evening, I returned absolutely worn out from loading luggage all day long at Paddington Station. I had missed my tea, to be shouted at by the corporal in charge to tell me to bloody well wake up, to get my stuff together and get back to Paddington Station, where I was being posted to number one, initial training wing at Babbacombe in Devon. Babbacombe is very close to Torquay, and to get to initial training wing was the first step towards becoming what I wanted to be, a pilot in the Royal Air Force. The training that we received there was more marching, more marching, more marching, and how to salute on the march, how to eyes right, eyes left, how to about turn without falling over, how to form fours, and the other side of it was to learn Morse, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da- and we learned it on the downs at Babbicombe with the flashing light with a Morse lamp. And of course in those days the Morse system of communication between aircraft and ships was widely used, not used today, and has been out of action, I believe, now for something like about 15 years. But I still remember my Morse. Dida is A, ba da di di dit is B, da dit is C, da dit dit is D, and so on and so forth. But having learned that, you never forget it. On top of that, of course, I was then 18 years of age, and I was 18, of course, when I joined the Royal Air Force. So I spent my 19th birthday buying half a pint of beer and feeling very, very daring and proud to spend my own money, fourpence halfpenny, on a half pint of mild and bitter. Also, I'd graduated into the world of admiring young ladies, and I used to dance hot, sweaty, in Torquay Town Hall. We used to take our jackets off, put our belts round our trousers, hide our jackets under the chairs so that we would know exactly where to get to, and dance and dance and dance and the night away until it got to about 9:45, when we would literally run all the way back from Torquay to Babbicombe, because if we were late, we got onto Jankers, and Jankers is being confined to barracks. I got confined to barracks quite a lot of time because I think the ladies in my life were becoming quite important. In fact, I'm still in touch with a sister of one. Sadly, the girl herself died shortly after I left her. I was a little bit in love with her for the first time in my life. Well, second time anyway. But anyway, from at Babbacombe, I certainly was not a great success because I was lined up with a lot of other boys one day when the sergeant called out, "Berriman," and I stepped out smartly, "Sir." And he said, "Get up to the boss's office, will you?" So I went up to the boss's office and he said, "Berriman, sit down." So I sat down. He said, "I've just seen your maths exam and your navigation exam results." I said, "Sir." He said, "I gather you were a bank clerk." I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "What bank?" I said, "Barclays, sir." And he turned round to the warrant officer beside him and he said, "Remind me to get down to Torquay and change my account to some other branch." And he said, "Your results are appalling. I am putting you back a flight," which meant going back 2 weeks in my training to retake some exams. I never retook those exams because suddenly there was a warning that we may have to have an embarkation leave. And we had been at ITW then for 7 weeks. I know now why I failed the exams. At school I was not very good at geometry or algebra, and of course navigation was in a way part and parcel of the geometry and the navigation setup. As far as adding and subtracting, nobody could do better because I had had banking training. I could add, subtract, multiply, divide, percentages, no problem at all. But when it came to things like algebra and geometry, it used to let me down a bit. So this call came and we were sent on embarkation leave back to London. I went overnight, being told to report in 3 days' time. So I had 3 days in which to say goodbye to my mother, not know where I would go next. I remember being taken to a jolly good show in London, which I think was the Crazy Gang at the London Palladium. They used to make me laugh. Flanagan and Allen, Norton and Gold, and Nerva and Knox. And I think that was the climax of my embarkation leave, because I arrived back early one morning at Babbacombe and put on another train to go to Wilmslow in Manchester. I got up to Wilmslow in Manchester together with all the other guys, and we spent another 2 days there, and then were put on a train to Greenock. When we got to Greenock, that was on the Clyde, I looked out across the Clyde to see a lot of big ships tossing in the October morning. And one of them was the Louis Pasteur. The Louis Pasteur, later to become the Bremen, was one of the fastest ships on the ocean. And she was being used as, she was a French ship, and she was being used as a troop carrier. We still didn't know where our destination was, and I suppose there must have been 1,000 of us. I won't say that they were all Air Force, some were Navy. I remember being thoroughly elated when I walked up that gangplank with my kit bag on my shoulders, having been issued with flying kit, to know that the Royal Air Force really did mean what they said and that I was going to be trained as a pilot. The troop ship was absolutely abysmal. It was crowded, it was dirty, and the eating arrangements were anything but hygienic. However, that we had to survive for a full 8 days.
What was the food like?
Passable, and it was cooked in the ship's galley. But on the second day out, we ran into an 80 mile an hour gale. And to a lot of wee boys that had never been to sea before, really, in a big ship, because our lives had been very protected in those days. It was a pretty horrific time. But as I say, I was used to roughing it, and I was fairly good at games, and I took it all with a laugh. And I only remember being sick once, whereas the other guys were sick dozens of times. I couldn't stand being down below, cooped up, and we were forbidden to go on the deck. However, as in most of my life, I broke most of the rules, and I got up on deck, and I slept on deck. I slept in the lifebelt racks, hidden in the lifebelt rack, anywhere rather than be down below where the heat and the smell was not nice. And but after 2 days, a storm passed, and we were delighted to see the Royal Air Force convoy protection aeroplanes over the top of us, Catalinas and Sunderlands. And alongside us were some American four-stack destroyers that had been allowed, we were allowed to have them as part of the lease-lend arrangement that was going on between the United States and Britain. And they were the old four-stacker World War I destroyers. But anyway, they did their job and they protected us from the U-boats, because the U-boat sinkings in October 1941 was as heavy as ever it had been. And we knew that the chances of being sunk at sea were considerable. After the third day, the ship suddenly changed gear and it started to cross the ocean at about nearly 30 knots, and it was going some. We left the destroyers behind and we went completely and utterly on our own, until suddenly, on about the seventh day, we saw the shores of Canada coming up. I was quite amazed to see the lovely shores of Canada with all the trees and all the fir trees, and I knew that we were arriving in Halifax, Nova Scotia.
Were you given lectures during this time?
No, not on the ship. Of course, when we were doing our training, we were given navigation and Morse lectures and aircraft recognition lectures and all this sort of thing. But on the ship, none whatsoever. On that ship, too, was an interesting bunch of blokes. Remember, it was 1941. The Battle of Britain was over in October the 30th, 1940. And Britain, politically, wanted to draw the United States into the war. And it became apparent to some of we youngsters that they were sending some Battle of Britain pilots, names I could easily say, and you would recognize every one. And they were being sent on a goodwill tour to lecture as to what it was like to fly at 30,000 feet. And we were very proud to be mixed up with these guys. During those intervening years, when I was playing football for Barclays Bank and a bit of cricket for Barclays Bank, I'd got mixed up with ENSA. And ENSA, because I was fairly good at amateur dramatics, and by this time I'd had a girlfriend that had taught me to play the ukulele, and I was a good mimicker. I was good at taking other people's voices off. And I'd worked up for the YMCA and for ANSA, which I used to do quite a lot of shows with in that year, 18 months that I was a civilian prior to the war. I did quite a lot of shows. And when I heard on the troop ship that anybody that had a dramatic turn up their sleeve, would they report to the dining room? I thought, well, here goes. And I went down to the dining room, and I watched a sailor, a round-hatted sailor, giving orders left, right, and centre. And he was saying, you do this, you do that, we'll do that, we'll do this, you do that, what can you do? And I said, because I was a little bit arrogant, and I said, what's your name? And he said, Redgrave, what's yours? And it was Michael Redgrave. And he was a seaman, and he was being sent out to the United States to bring back HMS Illustrious, which had been badly damaged and was in the United States for repair. However, I know the end of the Redgrave story, because he did come back on the Illustrious, but he was invalided out of the Royal Navy soon after he got back, and he then put in some very good work on the London stage. And then, of course, he had his wonderful daughters, didn't he? And I got mixed up with him a little bit later on, but that's another story. And Michael Redgrave, who was an absolute devotee of Mad Dogs and Englishmen, your ultimate day son. What was his name? You know, the wonderful actor. Anyway, everybody else would know it. And he sang that for that particular concert. When we arrived in Canada, we British boys were absolutely amazed to see the lights again, because we hadn't seen lights in London for a couple of years. Also, we were delighted to see that we were having some wonderful food, and two eggs and bacon and waffles and all the good food you could think of. And of course, we were the first British boys into Moncton, Halifax, near Halifax. Moncton was the name of the Royal Air Force Station, and we were the first British boys into that station. And the time, as near as damn it, was October the 17th, October the 20th. We were there for about 4 days, and we were delighted to make friends with all the Canadian young men and women, and the Canadians were very, very kind to us. And they knew we were a bit immature, and they knew we were a bit lost. Then absolute disaster happened, because you had made an awful lot of friends in these past 3 or 4 months. But one day, suddenly, somebody called out a roll call, and it was Adams, Berryman, Bakeley, Broughton, go to that section. And Peanuts, Provost, Pointer, go to that one. And we were divided up, and we lost all our friends in seconds. And I found myself on a train going down to the United States, going through Detroit, over the Great Lakes, on these wonderful, massive American trains, which we British boys had never seen anything like before. And the food was still wonderful, but it was going to be a roughly 3-day journey down over the Great Lakes and down to Montgomery, Alabama, where those of us that had been dispatched to Montgomery, Alabama, realized that we were to begin training with the United States Air Corps. The United States Air Corps training happened because there was a United States Air Corps general called Hap Arnold. And he was very much on Roosevelt's side, who was very much on Churchill's side, because they wanted to help Britain. And although the Yanks weren't in the war, they were doing their utmost to help us. As far as the training was concerned at Maxwell Field, Alabama, was concerned, it wasn't exactly to most of us, most of our liking, because we'd already gone through an ITW, initial training wing, and we literally started all over again. Now, it soon became very, very apparent to us that the Americans were going to train us, but they weren't going to train idiots, and they only wanted the very, very best that Britain could offer. I can assure you that the boys that were on that ship to become pilots dispatched by the British nation were anything but what the Americans were looking for, and they were going to be West Point graduates. We were bank clerks, Gas, Light and Coke Company employees, fruiterers, veterinary surgeons, doctors, anything, but certainly we were not West Point. And the rebellious streak, without doubt, came out in us, particularly somebody of my character. And it wasn't long before I was offending the holy laws, because I was always breaking some rule, not intentionally, but I've never been able to suffer fools gladly, and when somebody said jump, and there was no reason to jump, I would always say why. This has often got me into trouble. However, the United States did not expect you to say why, and we used to be hauled out of bed at literally 5:30 in the morning, and by 6 o'clock we had to be out on the parade ground, and we would be marched, about 40 of us at a time, to breakfast with a full band. I mean a full band, 20, 30 in that band blowing their instruments. Da-dee-da-dee-da-dee-da-dee-da-da-da-da-da-da. And off we used to march to breakfast. Well, you could imagine I was skipping and jumping and playing the fool. Anyway, it's like so many of us, but anyway, the long and the short of it was that it wasn't long before we realized that the American boys were certainly a class ahead of us. They were stronger, they were bigger, they could play games better, apart from soccer, which of course, which our game, and they couldn't play cricket, but we could play baseball. But in the main, they were better educated than we were. The same boys that were going through the Maxwell Field, Alabama, which was a big training establishment for the US Air Corps. In those days, of course, it was the United States Army Air Corps, not the US Air Force. But anyway, we suffered that, and we learned our rifle drill, and November the 11th came by, and I remember being on parade in Montgomery, Alabama, to honor Armistice Day in World War I. We had rifles with fixed bayonets, and believe you me, we were lethal with the fixed bayonets. I wasn't too bad, but I did see one bloke's head cut open, but in front of me, because of bad handling of the cadet behind him. But anyway, November the 11th passed by, and it wasn't long after that, with more ball and more ball and more ball, that I was dispatched to Arcadia in Florida, where I was obviously going to be trained under the Arnold scheme, and I've told you about General Arnold, and I got down to Arcadia in Florida, which was literally a cowboy film that you would see in a 1930s film. I mean, it was a cowboy town, the sort of town that you would have seen in a 1930s film. It was interesting because we were we were British, we didn't know the ways of the carrying on of how the Americans expected things to be done, and we were still learning. December the 2nd came, December the 7th came, and we were, I suppose, really quite delighted, and although the Americans were quite horrified, to hear that Pearl Harbor had taken place and the United States were in the war and we were in it up to our necks together. However, this wasn't going to alter the method of our training, and we were still expected to behave and have the common sense and the decorum of a West Point cadet. One thing I did not admire about their method of training was that they had upperclassmen and lowerclassmen. And the upperclassman was somebody that had done, shall we say, 4 weeks on the course, when you, a lowerclassman, you had done 1 week on the course. And what this, although he was the same rank as you, as in, usually the American, they were alongside the Americans, and they would suddenly say, fly, mister, fly. And we were expected to go down on our haunches and flap our arms and fly around the playground, you know. There is bull. It didn't go down too well. But anyway, and the honour system. I hated the honour system over the most stupid things, like somebody had pinched a bun for his supper and you were supposed to split on him. That was the honour system. And then I was in dead trouble when I was told that no way could any of us swim in this Florida swimming pool when the temperature was hotter than England had ever been, because it was too cold. Well, I didn't think it was too cold, so anyway, I got caught in the swimming pool and hauled over the coals. And I must have got some demerits. Meanwhile, I was just starting my flying training. And I remember getting into my instructor's aeroplane, which was a Stearman PT-17. I slung my leg over the cockpit and I was taken aloft for the first time, and I remember saying, well, there's not much to this. This is a bit of a doddle. I'd never been up in an aeroplane in my life, but I still didn't think it was very exciting. I don't know why I didn't. Anyway, I had just about soloed when New Year's Eve came along. And I went down into Arcadia, having had a miserable Christmas. I was so glad it was all over. I never liked Christmas. I hate Christmas. I loathe it. And we had a most miserable Christmas that Christmas, although the Yanks did their best to make it interesting for us. But I was confined to barracks and we couldn't do anything. I was bored out my brains. And then New Year's Eve, I went down into town with a couple of my friends, and we went to have a quick meal or a milkshake or something, because we hadn't got very much money. And I didn't drink, believe you me, I didn't drink. I mean, a half pint of beer was much. But about midnight, a good friend of mine, who later became Chief Constable of Staffordshire, and I were not very pleased to see a boy called Brodie. I remember his name because I saw him in a newsreel or something later in life. And he was a Scot, and you know the Scots got very peed up on New Year's Eve. And he was being hustled into a police car, and the police were hitting his legs with their nightsticks. And this didn't please... there were three or four of us, but particularly Ian Campbell, who would, had he survived the war, become Lord Campbell of Nairn. And I only mixed with the best people there. You know. Anyway, Ian Campbell and I sailed into these policemen and said, get off our mate. With the result, we all ended up in jail for the night. The rest